everyone, and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk Splits, a show where we take not one, but two former guests of the show, bring them back together. They may or may not know each other, but one thing we can guarantee is a great conversation. And today on the show, two people that definitely know each other, from the band The Butthole Surfers, the legends, Paul Leary and J.D. Pincus, return to the show. J.D. Pincus, this is his third appearance on this podcast, so he's like part of the roster now at this point. And my gosh, is this a fun conversation. But first, if you'd like to get in touch with this podcast, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother, Tristan Abraham, who also runs the Facebook page, @turnedoutofpunk, and the Instagram page, @turnedoutofpunk. And he's also the show's producer and the guest booker extraordinaire. This was his brainchild. Like, let's get Paul and Pincus on together. And I just get to enjoy the ride. Thank you, Tristan Abraham, for all the hard work you do. I love you, buddy. To get in touch with me, you head over to the email address, To get in touch with me on Instagram or Twitter, it's @LeftForDamien. To support the show, you just tell all your friends about it. I play in a band. We are called Fucked Up. We have a brand new record called Another Day. I'm super stoked about this thing. And we have done a limited edition Turned Out of Punk pressing of Another Day, which is available exclusively from Emissions Records here in Toronto. They are a store. You can go down to the store at Dundas and Ossington and grab it in person, or just go to their website, Instagram, social media, Emissions Records, Emissions Record Shop. You'll find it. Emissions Records Toronto. It'll come up and they have the record for you. It's a lot more affordable to mail order in Canada too, for the Canadian people that always complain about mail order costs. Don't worry, I'm thinking about you too. So find that record over there. And thank you to everyone who has already picked that thing up. That is that. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, today on the show, legends. If I ran this, you know, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, these guys would already be in there. Permanent exhibit, one of the greatest bands of all time. J.D. Pincus and Paul Leary have returned to the show from, of course, the gods, the Butthole Surfers. Now, the Butthole Surfers have had their whole catalog reissued now. They're all remastered, deluxe editions. Paul actually mentions there's also like an upcoming record in the fall, a live set from 1992 in New York. And I really feel like this is one of those bands that, in spite of how popular they are, in spite of how legendary they are, I don't think people really grasp how incredible, how wild, how extreme this thing was. Like, obviously people that are deep heads about this, but like, my gosh, this is a fun conversation. We talk about some of the most notorious people in music, and they've got stories for days. I'm excited for you to hear this thing. Head over to their Bandcamp and grab some of these reissues. I think a lot of the vinyl sold out already for these things, but maybe you find them at your local store. Butthole Surfers, you know, if you do not have the Butthole Surfers records in your collection, you need to rectify that ASAP. You can also not see the Butthole Surfers because they are not coming to your town, but there is a documentary about the Butthole Surfers that is very much at hand now, very close to coming out, and you can find out more information. I'll put that in the bio or the show description as well, where to go for more information to watch a trailer. I'm excited to see this documentary. I'm very excited to see it. Ooh, okay. Well, I'm not going to ramble on anymore because it's very late, as you can tell from my stumbling over my words right now. And I just want you to sit back, relax, and enjoy Paul Leary and J.D. Pincus as they return to Turned Out of Punk Splits. Paul and J.D., J.D. and Paul, welcome back to Turned Out of Punk.
Hello.
What's up, yo?
Well, I'm very excited to talk to both of you together because both of your separate appearances, I guess appearances in your case, Pincus, but like Paul, your last appearance on the show are some of my favorite conversations I've gotten to have. And, you know, like ahead of this documentary coming out, which I'm very excited to see, Butthole Surfers are a band that I just keep gaining respect for and also questions about. You know, it's a band that keeps like an onion
revealing layers of mystery to dissect. So I'm happy to dissect them both with you guys today.
Well, thank you for having us on, then.
Well, I wanted to start off by, you know, Paul, I guess last time we didn't really talk about it too much, because we talked about it when you were on the show, but like, do you remember the first time you met JD?
I think so. I believe it was in Atlanta, and we were without a bass player, and we were desperate to find a bass player, and someone recommended Pincus, and he came over for a practice, and about 5 minutes into the practice, I think we asked him to go to Europe with us, and that was it.
And I think 10 minutes after that, you said, I mean, you can stay in the band as long as you want, I guess.
Was it like about finding someone that could obviously play, but I guess more than that, that would gel with the vibe of the band? Because the band seems to have had a very distinct culture to it.
It was a matter of finding somebody that would do it, and because it was not an easy lifestyle. And I think Jeff came in prepared for the lifestyle, so he fit in pretty good.
Yeah. You know,
the bass player we had before Jeff got upset because we couldn't afford milk for him to drink every morning.
It's interesting because, like, commercial success the band would find, you know, and certainly, you know, chart success, it's like there's a question of why would you do it? You know, and I think a lot of people would look at the lifestyle and be like, well, why wouldn't you want milk in the morning? Or why wouldn't you want the comforts that this would provide? And I think that's like a lot of people pursue music, and especially now, for commercial goals. You know, like, I want people to hear this so I can become famous and well known and do it that way. But like, I don't know, there seems like almost there's like a deeper drive to it with Butthole Surfers at that time. With a name like that and the music you're playing, it's not driven by any sort of commercial goal.
No, and we were just playing stupid. Let's face it. We were stupid, and we didn't care. We didn't respect ourselves. We didn't respect our audience. We didn't respect anything. We just couldn't do anything else. Otherwise, we would have been doing it.
What do you think it was, Jeff?
Well, I mean, for me, you know, when I was told that we sleep on floors most of the time, I was like, so you're going to promise me a floor like every night? And they're like, yeah. I was like, well, that's pretty rad, man. I'm in. Because at that point, I was living in a warehouse. I was not living in a warehouse. I was living with some friends at that point. We had a place called The Bakery. It was like seven of us in a two-bedroom apartment, kind of like what Mitch Hedberg said one time about when he was being shown an apartment. They're like, well, there's two bedrooms in here. And he's like, actually, there's three bedrooms if you include the kitchen and whatever. And that kind of, I was already used to living like that. So to me, having stability that they were offering me of a floor every night was pretty amazing.
We didn't tell them that floor would be next to a cat box most of the time.
One time I bought them, when we finally made money, I bought like a North Face sleeping bag, and I got like the most badass one you could. And, you know, good for like minus 30 degrees. I was going to be ready for anything with one of those self-inflating pads. And I always ended up having to sleep next to the radiated heat coming off of the side of the warehouse. So I just woke up in a pool of sweat every night. The worst investment ever.
Yeah, that's the thing, though. You're doing it because there's like a drive to do it. Like, it's not because there's going to be a comfort to it. It's not necessarily because, you know, there's any sort of greater goal to it. You're just doing it because there's like a pull to make this stuff happen. And it's interesting because I know there's a lot of stuff with you guys that's kind of weirdly intertwined with REM. But I think if you kind of put the two bands against each other, you have almost like the two paths of post-hardcore American underground music, where there's sort of this pursuit of melody and commercial success. And then there's this other side of it, which is sort of this pursuit of this bohemian lifestyle to live for your art and to make as extreme art as possible.
I wanted commercial success too. It's just that I didn't have any fucking talent.
Like, you're naming the band Butthole Surfers. Like, I say this as someone who followed.
Yeah, we also weren't very smart. So. Jeff, you were talking about the sleeping bag. Was that the time we all bought sleeping bags together as a band.
Gibby
got the flu, and 6 months later, he still had the flu, and we realized we needed to get sleeping bags or he would never get well. So we went into a sporting goods store, and we all bought sleeping bags with the self-inflating pads, and man, that was just, that was luxury. That was
I bought a silk liner.
A what?
A silk liner. It was like a little sock that you get into, you know, like inside. It was like a silk sheet that you put inside of it.
We didn't get any of those. How come you got one? Mr. Special.
The comfort that success in music provides people. But like prior to that success, was it just like to do this as long as possible? Like there's no future planning going involved into what you're doing.
I just knew I wasn't going to go back to working at the lumberyard, and I didn't think I was going to be alive in another 5 years, so I personally just didn't care.
Why don't you show off your two full sets of fingers?
Like what?
Is that because he didn't work at the lumberyard?
Oh yeah.
He was the only one there that had all of his fingers, so he was like the they could tell he was the rookie.
When the band first moved to Los Angeles in 1982, we played a show, and then the next thing you knew, we realized we didn't have a place to live or food to eat. So I was the one in the band that got a job. I got a job at a downtown lumberyard, and I had to take two bus lines to get there in the morning. And everybody I worked with was missing thumbs and fingers and shit, and working with these giant cutoff saws that were 6 feet in diameter and had no safety on them. And I had to get out of there. So that didn't last long.
But Paul does know a lot about hardwood. Malignum wheatai, the strongest wood in the world.
Malignum wheatai.
And that's knowledge that serves you for the rest of your life. You know, I'm sure that came into play with the band at some point.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of stories of lignum wheatai.
I think it's interesting when you talk to people that grew up in different places, post-punk kind of happening, like their experiences with it. Like, I think if you grew up with it in, say, London or California, like Los Angeles or Toronto, it's different because there's a lot of people into it. Or not necessarily a lot, but it just feels like there was like almost like a critical mass that was reached with youth culture where you might have been fucked with, but there were still enough people around you. What was it like kind of post, you know, that Sex Pistols show in terms of like getting into this stuff where you're growing up in Texas at that point?
Well, yeah, I grew up in San Antonio and punk did not catch on very big there, but we were fortunate enough to have the Sex Pistols play, and I was there at that show. And then
you also were the Sabuda film for the Sex Pistols show, where now we finally know where the beer that exploded Sid Vicious' face in one of the most infamous images to come out of the Sex Pistols American tour came from, the man beside that, you.
That, yeah, that was not me. That was I had a friend that went with me, and he got drunk, and I think he was doing speed, and he spent the entire show throwing beer cans at Sid Vicious, and I was not impressed. I wasn't into that. I wanted to see the Sex Pistols, and so after that night, I didn't hang out with that guy anymore after that.
But that it's like, and it's not that to say that's a positive thing, but if there's one enduring image of Sid Vicious on stage, it's that image. And like, for better or for worse, I'm sure certainly Sid probably would prefer his nose was kept intact. But if there's like, that's so iconic in terms of this music and has done so much on a graphic level to be kind of like an arresting image, like the power that image has. And so once again, yeah, like you're saying, the guy who threw it, kind of an asshole for throwing that beer, but
way asshole,
but the results of that were cataclysmic, like far greater than just potentially breaking Sid Vicious's nose.
It was weird because I went home and turned on the news, and the news was all over that Sex Pistols show. Every news station in town sent cameras and reporters there. And there was people selling like fake safety pins that you could put on your cheek and make it look like it was pinned through your cheek, but it was really just a gag. And it was kind of weird.
Sorry, let me cut you off.
No, I was just going to say, I didn't listen to the Sex Pistols quite so much after that night because it was just such a spectacle. And it's like, I didn't really get the spectacle of it that much. I liked their music, and then after that, there was other bands to like.
Well, I guess the other show that Sex Pistols played on that tour, which has sort of like more as much enduring images, I say even more than that San Francisco final show, is that Atlanta show. You know, and the people that were at that Atlanta show, like be it the B-52s or the fans, and kind of like what that did to Athens, I guess, which was kind of going already, but in Atlanta as well. Like, I think those are two key shows in both of those scenes. Like in Atlanta, it's that way, Pincus, right?
Yeah, that was the first show of their tour in the States, I believe. I was too young to go out there. I'm the baby of the band. And I have to say also that Paul, that's the first story I've heard you talk about going to music with a friend that wasn't your buddy Flavio. So I'm glad, glad that you got Flavio for the better stories of your rock and roll past.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with Flavio. We got kicked out of Grand Funk Railroad, and we got kicked out of Creedence Clearwater Revival, and we got to shoot the finger at the pigs and drink whiskey from a canteen, because back then nobody ever checked your canteen to see what was in it.
I didn't even know you had another friend.
No, that was it.
But yeah, Atlanta was definitely, effectively, you know, Atlanta, to date myself to him younger, I mean, I remember seeing Ozzy Osbourne's first solo show in Atlanta. It was a place where people could go to, or a big city. There was not a huge media following. It wasn't like LA or New York, but it was a good warm-up show for probably whatever they were trying to figure out, a good place to land. And I believe they played the Agora Ballroom, which I've seen many shows at. But that was definitely legendary. I wish I would have been a couple of years older. I think I was 11 at the time when they played there. So it was a little young for me to get out there for that one.
I find both Georgia and Texas produce some of the most unique kind of punk scenes too. Like, people, like, especially as hardcore kind of goes on and there's a uniformity that kind of sets in on different sounds and different scenes. I find like there's just so many weird, unique takes on punk that are coming out of various cities in Texas, and same with Atlanta and Athens too. Like, there's both like bizarre, like neither one has sort of like Minor Threat clone bands in the same way that a lot of places.
I think we had to kind of like do our own thing in Atlanta, because we didn't get anything from the West Coast until like 4 years after it hit. By the time, I remember the first time seeing like JFA and everybody, you know, we had great college radio, WRAS, and it was Georgia State and Georgia Tech. And they both had, that's how I listened to most of my stuff. I used to record some of that stuff off the radio so I could listen to it again. And we were lucky to have that kind of thing, but bands couldn't reach us. We got a lot of the East Coast bands, all the initial bands, D.I.G.I., STD, then there was the Marginal Man, Reagan Youth, there was a bunch of the East Coast stuff that came down. But when West Coast bands came through, I remember we gave TSOL, like we kind of were like, it was a later day TSOL, and I remember they showed up to the Metroplex in a limousine. And we were all like, what the fuck is this, man? And we go, how fucking West Coast is that? But we didn't realize that it's cheaper to put everybody in their gear that they had to bring in a limousine than it would be to like get, you know, two taxi cabs and do whatever. Cause you know, we're all young and stupid, you know, but it did look kind of funny to see a limousine pull up to the Metroplex.
What's that band from Atlanta where they call the guy the G.G. Allin of the South and used to play those shows with a gun on his hip?
I don't know. G.G. used to come through and he would send his tapes out and have different regional bands around there.
No, this guy was a singer in a band. He died in prison.
Chris Wood?
Yeah, I believe so. What was his band called? Yeah. Start with an R?
Restraints.
Restraints.
Whacka, whacka, whacka on a bear behind. She provokes me to do it, and it suits me just fine. Yeah, he had I Can't Be a Nun. I'm Too Fond of Fun. Yeah, he used to shoot his insulin in his head on public TV, public access TV. He was, you know, his bald head, so he would shoot his insulin up there because I guess he was diabetic. And he, from what I remember, he had a Jewish girlfriend that he shot. And his defense was he was trying to see how close he could get to her without hitting her. And he had a bunch of Nazi memorabilia at his house. So it didn't line up too good in court when that happened. But that's just my memory. I'd have to look. I'd have to Google that stuff to see if that's actually what happened. But the restraints, Freddie Vomit, and Wee Wee Pole, and I believe we talked about, you know, RuPaul's, you know, I want gum. Who wants gum? I do. You know, there was a lot of an interesting scene in Atlanta for sure. You know, but it was so much different than the rest of the country because we didn't really have anything to base it off of, I guess.
Yeah, like it's interesting, like when you put, you know, the restraints and that sort of tragic sort of story side by side with, you know, yourself, RuPaul, Laura from Merge, Neon Christ, and like sort of like all the amazing stuff that kind of comes out of this punk scene. Like there's a lot of interesting stories that are part of this Atlantis thing. Like it's definitely an under talked about scene outside of like that sort of initial first wave of boom that kind of happens with stuff there with the fans and all that kind of stuff.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, Neon Christ was the house band at the, and DDT were the house bands at the Metroplex, and they played with pretty much everyone that came through. If someone played two nights, one night was with Neon Christ, one night was with DDT. You know, that was kind of a, you know, I don't know. I think we just showed up to everything that came out, you know, the old Metroplex. And then when I was, you know, the newer Metroplex was where we did most of the Double Live album that Butthole Surfers did. We recorded all over, but seems like most of the stuff we used was from that was recorded from Ricky, our old sound man, from a DAT player live at the Metroplex, and it just sounded best then, I guess, at the, you know, the new Metroplex. But that was pretty hoity-toity. I still wouldn't sit on any of the couches there, but it was a definite upgrade from the old one with the mattress tied around a pole. And the stage was about a foot off the ground. I remember when the first time I saw security there was the Circle Jerks. And we were like, what do they got these three guys standing up here for? What the fuck are they doing? But that was the first show I ever saw with security.
The Circle Jerks seemed to be the band, like even more than Black Flag, that would show up and it would just pull out like a bunch of, you know, kids from the suburbs or a lot more violent kind of vibe.
Yeah. Definitely so. I think people didn't understand what, you know, how to react to the music or what the bands wanted the bands to, and the folks to react to. It was, you know, like I remember Henry Rollins getting mad. It was this really hot show. Everybody was on blue gel acid and Henry got hit by an ice cube and he stopped the show. It was like, you know, summer in Atlanta. I would have been like, more ice cubes, please. But yeah, you know, we didn't know what to do, you know. Flipper got mad at us because we wouldn't move because we were all tripping too hard. And we were so excited. It was the first time they ever made it there. I still remember the flyer with the broken down van on it. It was just a black and white flyer. And we were just stoked to have them out there. And they were like, don't burn the place down, kiddies. And we loved it. We just couldn't move. We were tripping too hard. The blue gel was pretty heavy back then around the Atlanta scene.
I remember actually hearing, I think it's in the Atlanta hip hop documentary that Vice did about how Atlanta is such a conduit for drugs in America because it's like an intersection of a bunch of the different highway systems and how a lot of stuff moves through Atlanta and that it's, and in my experience there are a lot of different, there's a lot of parties that can be found in Atlanta in a way that you don't find in a lot of cities.
It seemed more like Texas, you know, maybe that's when we lived there. It's like where Paul was at in San Antonio. And, you know, now, you know, we're 10 and you know, where everything hits 35 and 10, there's a big hub, that area. Was definitely the later day hub. I never really knew about it. I didn't really study hubs of drugs when I was a kid. I just give me my acid and my whatever I was doing back then. We pretty much did what I was an opportunivore. Whatever someone put in front of me, I'd do.
I guess the dichotomy is supposed to be punk and hippie, and there's like this huge gulf between the two. But it's amazing how many different scenes and punk bands were and hardcore bands and stuff were fueled by acid. Like acid definitely was the drug in San Francisco for all those Berkeley bands, and seems like it's kind of the drug for a lot of the interesting bands happening around that time.
Yeah, that's kind of odd to think about, isn't it? Yeah, like out of all the, yeah, that is a weird crossover. But like I said, I don't know how much was just being an opportunivore and how much was that I just really wanted to do, you know, I really want to find that headspace of acid. It was more like, what are we partying on today? And that was just always around. But yeah, I'm sure Paul's got his own views on that stuff because he grew up in a different place, different time, different place. But yeah, for us in Atlanta, there was definitely, yeah, you know, unfortunately, that was when like crystal meth was around and acid, and yeah, you know, weed would kind of suck back then. I remember when I joined the bus and they were in Atlanta, and they were like, I'll never forget. They're like, do you know where to get some good weed? And I was like, yeah. And they looked at me and I was giving a Paul, and they're like, no, like good weed. And I'm like, yeah. And then they're like, no, do you know where to get good weed? And I was like, maybe not. I don't know. And so we ended up finding this one guy on the east side. He's dead now because it was tough. But he was like, I've got the good, the better, and the unusual. And that was where I think we actually found some weed when I joined up with those guys. But yeah, they had a much better radar for good weed than I did. We just had the brick stuff or whatever, you know. Sometimes we get some of the compressed, good stuff from Mexico, but it wasn't good weed. That's when I realized I didn't know what good weed was.
Where did you guys get acquainted with the idea of like sort of the idea that there is this sort of higher grade level of cannabis out there? Because like Pincus is saying, it wasn't common back then.
Hey, I grew up in San Antonio and we had it there, you know, that back in the 70s, even the early 70s, you know, by the mid 70s, there was Santa Marta Red and Colombian Gold and stuff that I still miss to this day. They just, you know, they don't sell that kind of weed anymore. And I miss it. It looked good. It smelled good. And it was fun. And now it's just potent. And yeah. I miss the 70s.
Yeah, it's interesting how everyone talks about sort of like the eradication that happened of a lot of these older strains and throughout the 80s and into the 90s, where there's terpenes and flavor profiles that you'll never find again. And there's like usually people that go and their whole mission is to try and back cross these strains to try and get back to those old profiles because, yeah, they hit different.
We used to get this stuff in the 70s called, I think it was Oaxacan, and it was lime green colored. And it was about 90% its weight in giant seeds. And you'd have to go through it and pick the little seed sheaths off of the seeds. But when you went through all that and you ended up with about a half a gram of actual weed out of an ounce, it was amazing. And that, you know, I missed that, you know, even though you had to work with it with the seeds and all.
It's changed so much. And now even like post-legalization in Canada, it's changed again, where I had a friend reach out to me the other day who was traveling with like a really well-known country musician, that same sort of thing that they did to you, Jeff. They're like, can you get good weed in Canada? And I'm like, well, yeah, they sell it at all the stores. They're like, no, 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 good weed. This is terrible. We need good weed. And they flew to Toronto from another city to try and get the good weed because they were just so sick of the stuff that was available to them. And it's just, yeah, it's interesting as things are getting quote unquote better, it's not necessarily bearing out for the cannabis that we're smoking.
Well, I think people forget about, I mean, not to be a weed nerd, people forget about the CBD is kind of an important part of marijuana. And nowadays people just want to see 29% THC and they don't really care about the mix. You got to have the fuel to the fire, and the CBD is actually what helps with that. So I think people, you know, they get caught up in numbers and advertising, and they found out that most weeds, you know, other than the terpenes, are pretty much the same. And a lot of those numbers are just made up. And, you know, if I had a store, I'd probably make them up too. I don't know. But that's why I don't have a store.
Yeah. And I think the access to shitty cannabis in the back of the day is probably what motivated a lot of other drugs use. And a lot of, like you were saying, like, if maybe people had access to good weed and stuff that was worth smoking, people wouldn't be opportunivores as much when it came to the stuff that was coming in front of them.
Yeah, I don't know. I think opportunivorism is a lifestyle, you know.
Was that at all a motivator with the band when you guys would travel, Paul, back then? Like, where were you guys going to be able to find?
Oh, yeah, we had to go through San Francisco and all the way up through to Seattle because that was where the good stuff was. You know, back in the mid 80s, San Francisco sold weed that smelled like, tasted like cough syrup. It was like cherry cough syrup. And I miss that stuff. And then Seattle had the really good stuff. And yeah, that's where we always ended up heading. Where was the West Coast, you know, San Francisco and on north.
When was the first time you guys crossed over into Vancouver?
Oh, hell, I don't remember.
Way later, probably. Would have been later than
that. No.
I remember we crossed over when right before the Bay Bridge, the earthquake deal. We were with Camper Van Beethoven, but that's when I remember being young and going over there. I'm sure we might have gone over there before then, but I remember being when that earthquake hit. It was pretty. That was what year was that? Was that 86, 87, somewhere around
like San Francisco, Oakland.
Yeah, when the big one hit out there. But we just crossed over, and I remember us being at the I-beam and having the tremors, and that was the first time I'd ever been in an earthquake before. And I was I had like two beers, and I was standing in the stall taking a piss, and I had to put my hands up on the walls of the stall. And I was like, "Whoa, man, what kind of beers are these?" And then I hear Teresa scream, "Earthquake!" From the other bathroom. And that was like my very first earthquake, but I believe that was right before the big one hit, and we were over in Vancouver then. I don't recall being in Vancouver before then. Do you, Paul?
I just remember going into Canada and thinking we'll be really smart and we'll get some duct tape and we'll tape our weed stash to the bottom of a picnic table at a restaurant before we cross over. And then coming back, not being able to remember what picnic table it was.
You probably got decent weed though up in Canada around then, right? Because there was a lot of cannabis in the punk scene, I've heard.
Yeah, it was all right, but you know, we would play there and get enough to get us through the shows, and then come back to Seattle, and then things would get better again. So Seattle was pretty happening.
It's interesting because also at that point in across Canada, it was like obviously the same as America, where by the time you hit Toronto, there was a lot of hash here. But there was not a lot of flour, and it was a lot closer to kind of what Atlanta, I guess, would have been like, a lot of brickweed and a lot of.
Well, that's kind of like Holland, you know, like they didn't have when we went over there. They had crappy weed, and we would get the. I remember we started. I don't know which one. If it was Paul who figured out how to roll a pure hash joint, but we didn't want to mix it with tobacco or nothing, and we would take scores on how many times it would ruin it. We'd be like, hold it upright and don't tip it. Don't knock it. Don't try and get the ashes off it. And if it fell on you, it burned like napalm. But we were getting way higher doing that than we would with the tobacco ones. And then I remember when the weed was better, we went to the central station place, and we got some weed from them. And then we went next door to roll it and play some pool, and they had a bar in there. And these Dutch folks saw us rolling pure, you know, weed joints, and they were like, "Whoa, you're going to get very high like that." And we're like, "Yeah, I know." You know, I believe Paul actually like was smoking a joint, talking to a cop just because he could one time, asking for directions. Yeah, we were very easily amused back then.
Yeah, well, we pulled into the train station, and I got out of the car smoking a joint, and I realized I was face to face with a police officer. So I accidentally blew a hit out in his face and said, "Excuse me, can you tell me where the train station is?" And he goes, you were at the train station." It's like, all right.
What about there was cigarette smoke going on in between the carts. They didn't mind the weed smoke when we were on the train, but we'd be up in the little front area, but someone lit up a cigarette, and that just pissed everybody off. When the door opened, they could get the cigarette smoke in there. They seemed to be tolerant of the weed smoke, but not the cigarettes. Smoke
the way it should be, god damn it.
Yeah, I hear you.
So would you guys mainly smoke joints back then, or would you try and like make pipes and chill them to kind of preserve the weed a little bit more?
Oh, lots of joints, big old fat ones.
Yeah, we didn't like carrying paraphernalia with us and stuff, and you know,
we'd laugh at New York. We'd go there and these people would like roll joints where it was like the least amount of pot possible you could roll into a joint, and it looked more like a toothpick. And god, we go, "Okay, can you roll me about 30 more of those?" Because
now I call my pinkest pinners. Since I'm traveling by myself all the time, I like to roll them as small as possible. Like, it's basically an elongated roach, so I can smoke them real quick and get rid of them. So there is an art to the pinkest pinner, but not when you've got five mouths to feed.
Yeah.
We used to think that if you held it in longer, you'd get higher. So me and Paul were pretty ridiculous with how long we could hold a hit in. In fact, on the song Bong Song is off of Widower Maker, is me and Paul's bong hits are on there, and both of us are doing what we usually do, and that's holding it in as long as possible, because we only had, like, you know, if all of us were smoking, we had to get the most out of each hit that we could.
Yeah, now I can't smoke anymore at all.
At all.
Not, my lungs can't take it anymore.
What about gummies?
I do gummy. I have a prescription for medical gummies for chronic pain, so I do that. But, you know, it's not the same.
But it's chronic pain is Gibby. No, I'm kidding.
I find like that's a lot of my friends who, even straight edge friends, like as they're getting older, they're starting to have a relationship to cannabis through gummies, because pain management or trying to sleep better at night, like it just feels like it's a lot more of a natural way to kind of deal with these things before you start hitting it with hard prescriptions.
I don't know how good it is for pain, but you know, when I do it, I just don't care about the pain quite as much. It doesn't go away. I just don't care about it as much.
That's the kind of thing that people say about it with pain management. It's more for pain management. It doesn't treat the pain. You're still in pain, but you just care about it less. And that's kind of, I think that's the thing that it does with people and their anxiety too. Like I use it to treat anxiety, and I find, you know, the thing that I'm anxious about doesn't go away. I just don't give a fuck about it as much.
There you go.
I think the edibles are totally different. I mean, we know that that your body digests it different. It becomes a different chemical. I don't appreciate eating it near as much as I like smoking it because of the effect that you get from smoking it. And that, to me, it's like, you know, it's like the difference of a baked potato. Like cooking it, you don't know when it's going to be ready, as opposed to eating French fries that you get at a fast food place. I want to smoke a joint and I want to get high right then. And then if I want to get high later, I'll do another joint. But if you take an edible or too much of an edible, and you know, like I remember someone gave us some chocolates on the road on a later day Butthole Surface tour, and I ate some, went to sleep. I woke up and I tried to check my messages on my phone, and I saw a bunch of letters, but none of them made sense whatsoever. It wasn't like my normal smoking. You know, I've never had that from just smoking weed, where I couldn't read my letters on my phone, but people were texting to me. So, you know, I think it depends on, you know, what you're doing. Like for me on the road by myself, it'd be hard to do edibles. People offer me all the time, and I'm just like, no, I just much rather prefer my French fries, which would be to smoke one instead of to, you know, to wait for the potato to hit me.
It is different. Like for me, like I smoke, and I smoke like a normal person, but if I have edibles, my dose is way too, like I have to have about 1,000 milligrams before I start feeling it.
Whoa.
And it's, jeez. And it's, I've had up to 5,000 milligrams. I know a guy who takes 10,000 milligrams. This is dose.
Whoa. Good Lord. That's weird.
Yeah,
it's, I know, intense. A guy does 500 and plays shows, and I was blown away by that, man. But yeah, I'm not of that level.
You were on that tour. No, you weren't. No, we did a tour one time with the Melvins, and I took 500 before I went on stage one night. We went to a place in Vancouver now. There's a store where you can buy acid, and I bought a quarter hit of acid and played a show. I felt I was like playing cosplaying Butthole Surfers that night a little bit. I'll tell you, dumping a bottle of water in your head hits much different after that hit of acid. But a quarter hit, yeah. Like you get shots off the bar of quarter hits of acid, or they had cocaine or Coca Cola with coca added back into it, coca tea, coca coffee, mescaline analogs, and it's all like you can pay with debit. They check your ID. It's all tested. It's like the
where is this?
In Vancouver. That's rad.
Where?
Right off Main Street, like right Main and Hastings.
What city are you talking about?
Vancouver, Canada.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's, I tell you, it is a glimpse into the future of.
I have not been to Vancouver in a while.
What a time to be alive, huh, Paul?
Too old.
I think it's interesting too with the Butthole Surfers because every band had like their wild band, but you guys were seemingly like the wild band, like the truly the wildest of the wild, and sort of like, and I mean this in the best possible way, like true freak core.
That's what brought in the crowds.
Yeah, like, but I guess the scene that out of Texas that I would associate you guys with, and it's not really, I guess, localized to one scene, but like, and maybe you guys didn't even interact much with each other, but like Culture Side, Bobby Sox, Sick Men with Ray Guns, Big Boys too, like truly like outsider kind of views on this music. And it's once again like a statewide thing, I guess, because a bunch of these bands are from different cities, but like true freak core.
Stick Men with Ray Gun, what an amazing band. And Bobby, I was lucky enough to these guys are a little, they introduced me to those guys. But I'd say Bobby Beamon and his bass tone was one of the things that inspired my bass sounds that I liked a lot. And Bobby Sox, or Bobby Wayne, whatever he was going by at the time. And for some reason I don't know, he took a liking to me, probably because I snorted speed off of his knife one time. And it's kind of like if you snort speed off his knife one time, then you're always friends with him, I guess. But the stories that I heard
And
before.
when you say off his knife, don't forget he was chopping it up on a Bible.
Yeah. He had his chop, chop, chop too, with all the knives. He had all his knives stuck in this piece of wood. And yeah, he was such an amazing someone needs to do a buy-up on him. Chris Wood, him, they're like those two are like guys that would really make an amazing story, better than the G.G. Allin story. We all know how that is. It's got a shitty ending.
First time I saw Stickman, I got right in front of Bobby Sox, and at some point during the show, he just hauled off and kicked me in the balls. Oh, Paul, I'm sorry I kicked you in the balls. I didn't know who you were.
And he was getting a blowjob on stage, but couldn't get it up. And then he chased everybody left. He started swinging the microphone and a stand, and everybody left the room. And then he begged everybody to come back in.
Yeah, we played with them in Houston, and they opened up for us. And during their show, he took the vocal mic and stuck it up his butt and hopped around on stage. And then after they were done, Gibby went and exchanged the vocal mic with the kick drum mic. I'll never forget that. But
Too bad he didn't put the kick drum back up his ass.
if you've ever toured live in crappy club scene, you know how bad those vocal mics smell. They smell freaking terrible.
I could not imagine that one though.
I've always carried my own mics because of such stories. I have a backup in case I leave the one that I've got on stage. So there's no way I'm using a house mic ever.
It's funny trying to like as a fan placing the Butthole Surfers, because you guys always seem so outer worldly, like you're in a universe unto yourself at every different time. But like I saw a photo today, like a promos photo of you, Pink is wearing the pink Lincoln shirt. And I'm like, oh yeah, you guys would have played with those bands too, or like, you're part of this whole Texas
Magma.
thing. Yeah, like, but there's like all this sort of stuff that you guys could like not be at all at home in, but because you're not at home in any one place, you're existing in all these weird disparate scenes. Like maybe the only band that played with Smegma, Stickmen with Ray Guns, Ice-T, and Pink Lincolns on Earth, and probably would have been equally at home with all of them.
I think the weirdest band that we ever played was with was Gregory's Funhouse. I don't know if you're familiar with those guys at all. It was like a band of long-haired junkies fronted by a long-haired preacher guy who carried a Bible everywhere, including on stage, and would preach to the crowd and would preach backstage and would yell at his band backstage for being junkies. And we toured with these guys. And I just thought he was a nut that liked to preach a lot. And then on last show, he gave us a videotape of that he wanted us to watch. So we go out to the bus, and we put in this tape, and it's him, the preacher guy that we've been touring with, and it's a tape of him getting a blowjob from a girl with Down syndrome. And we're just like, oh my God. And then the next scene was him putting that Bible that he was carrying around on the ground, and he climbs up on a stool and took a dump on that Bible, and the log that came out of his butt was about 4 feet long. And that point, the you know, we had to turn that video off and throw it out the window. We didn't want to get stopped.
It
that.
Took us. It took us that long, though. That's what's funny about that.
Holy shit!
We couldn't take it after the 4 foot shit.
That's fucking crazy. Was the whole thing bullshit, and it was just like a work, or was he like
You know as much as we do now. So
how did this tour come about, Paul?
Oh, I don't know. How did anything come about? We just woke up and there we were.
Like, was what era would this have been? Like that 90s? Been
late 80s.
Holy shit. I've never heard of that.
Like, yeah, that was on the East Coast. I think they were from New York or someplace like that. And so a lot of weird bands from that area.
Were there ever bands that you kind of like felt like you were on the same wavelength with that you would meet on tour?
You know, maybe like Meat Puppets. You know, which was a big inspiration for all of us and for me particularly, because I'd stopped playing guitar in college. And then I heard Meat Puppets, might have been their first single, where they played a song called Out in the Gardener or in a Car. And it was a train wreck. And this was like, wow, I could do that. I had to pick up a guitar again after hearing that stuff.
What about you, Pingus?
Well, I mean, I was like, I was thinking of like, you know, when I first joined the band, it was more, a lot more art rock than it was that we got into doing playing music. I think I started writing, you know, some more stuff and, you know, for the band as I was in the band longer, but I was not as art rock as I was into like playing songs, I guess. And so, we kind of gelled into more of a songwriting band, but you know, like when you're talking about which bands we matched with, like Tragic Mulatto from San Francisco, that was kind of like performance art, but you know, stuff mixed with the music in there. I'd say the attitude of the Meat Puppets from like to, you know, people always talk about punk rock. I won't even go into the idea of the punk rock museum or any of that stuff, but. You know, to me, we were always post-punk, and like the Meat Puppets, like Paul said, they were, to me, inspirational because they could play Tumble and Tumbleweeds naked in front of a black flag, you know, crowd, and just to piss the black flag crowd off, you know, play that, you know, for an extended period of time. And that to me was, you know, punk rock was pissing off the people that thought they were punk rock, you know? So it was kind of like an attitude thing, but you know, like to me, I was too late for punk rock. You know, like I said, I was 11 when the Sex Pistols hit. So when I hear people like talking about punk rock, you know, this and that, it's kind of confusing to me because what my view of it, and everybody should have their own view. No one should be able to be told what punk rock is. You know, punk rock, you know, was never that. You don't tell a band on your label, if you really want to be punk rock, you'll do this. You know, you gotta let the bands blossom and do what they want. That's truly punk rock, you know? So I don't know. That's a weird concept for me to even compare bands. Everybody was doing their thing. However they want it to be perceived, I guess you can label it whatever. But to me, it was just like the attitude of not caring what the crowd thinks about it and doing your art was kind of more of what was punk rock to me about it, even though to me, I consider what we did post-punk. You know, I mean, I joined the band at the end of 85. First show was January 10th, 86. To me, that was kind of post-punk, you know. I remember the No Wave years. That was so cool. I loved all the No Wave bands and all the music that came out of that. But, you know, I mean, to me, the Germs were like one of the best punk rock bands, you know, that I ever heard. You know, that was beautiful stuff. In fact, when I joined the Butts, I had my leather jacket and I just had a Germs GI blue ring on the back of it. And that was my punk rock jacket at the time. And I think it might have been that helped me get in the band. I don't know.
Definitely helped.
Obviously the band comes out of punk rock from the conversations I've had with both of you and the stuff I've done researching the band on my own. But at the same time, like you're saying, it doesn't fit in with whatever people's forced definition of punk rock is. It's punk rock in a way that defies definition, like the music, the vibe. And because of that, the influence you have on future generations of punk rock is
unarguable. And like it forever changes the course of punk rock. So as much as it is post-punk, it's still so punk that it affects punk forever after it.
But there
cracks me up to think about future generations of punk rock. That cracks me up no end.
Yeah, me too. I totally agree. That's what I was just saying. That's just, to me, it's like we should, that stuff should be in a museum, I guess, but the museum should be, I don't know. It would be wrong of me to say when punk rock started or when it ended, because that's the whole idea of punk rock. It shouldn't have a definition, I guess. But future, I don't know. They should just call it something different, maybe.
when we first started, there was also new wave, and nobody ever talks about new wave anymore. But there was a time when new wave was actually cool, and then there was a bunch of fucking shitty new wave bands, and it became too embarrassing to even mention the words new wave. But
that's why I said no wave, because I like the no wave stuff. I had that no wave compilation. That stuff was, that even had the Police on it. And Joe Jackson. It was some stuff that was pretty hard hitting, but really tight. Like Roxy Music was a very tight experimental band with great musicians and stuff. I don't know. What comes to mind is how upset Paul got when we were considered the godfathers of grunge, and the whole idea of being godfathers of grunge really rubbed him the wrong way, I remember. And that was just some journalist's idea to call music grunge and then to call us godfathers of it.
Capitol Records wanted to market us as the godfathers of grunge, and I told him I would quit the fucking band if they did that.
Yeah. So I think labeling stuff is just for journalists. Why can't people just, it's like writing a description of a painting. Why don't you just let everybody see the fucking painting and let them decide what they think it is, instead of trying to cram, everything into its own little quadrant of kind of music. I think that kind of stifles people, because people want to understand and they want to be able to call it something, but they can't just enjoy it for what it is, which is just music,
Absolutely. But I think there's a power in naming something, and there's also a power in this thing that keeps providing power to young people, that they're able to tap into this history of bands that saw the world a completely different way from each other, even, but all were motivated to just do it themselves and to keep just doing it themselves. And that's the thing about it. Like I say this as someone who's no longer tapped into the younger punk scene. Like the kids are completely moved way past me at this point. But it still has power for kids, and there's still kids that are doing unique things, and still people that wind up doing stuff that has nothing to do with whatever punk is in other places, but found that sort of freedom to express themselves from being involved in this thing. So
speaking of freedom, whatever happened to the Shags?
I think there's that documentary about them that came out a couple of years ago, going back to on air.
Now that's what I want to see. I love that, man.
Absolutely. And that's the thing, is like there's DIY music going back before punk. Absolutely. The bands have been doing this themselves ever since, music began. But the pride in doing it yourself, I think, is where punk comes in. And the idea that doing it yourself isn't something to be embarrassed of, or isn't a stopgap before someone else comes along. Like it's valid doing it yourself. In our case,
we had to do it ourselves because nobody else was going to fucking help us. I mean, we were all on our own. You mentioned that you just recorded a 24-hour session. You made an album and put it out in the same day. Our first EP was recorded in one day and mixed in one day, or might have even been recorded and mixed all in one day. And shoot, now it takes me a month just to think of a bridge for a song. So.
But like, we were inspired by hearing stories like that, or hearing Husker Du recording Landspeed record stories, or like these sort of like legendary records that came out of bands being forced into this position. And then being a kid and being like, shit, we don't have the right gear. We don't dress right. We don't look cool. But that's okay. There's been bands that put fucking clothespins in their hair and take acid on stage and made it work. So we can make it work.
We're also in an age of social media and cell phones. And I don't think the Butthole Surfers would have been the same if we would have been in this, like the way people would describe us to their friends, which we would count on for them to come out and see us play, was like they would try and describe, well, they got these screens and that there's like three, well, there's this chick that she's naked and she's, yeah, there's just no way really to describe it unless you see it. And so if nowadays people just put their phone up in the air and like, this show is cool. And people see it and go, oh, that's cool. I'll have to check that out someday. You know, it was a different time then. And we were more of a spectacle because people didn't know what to expect because there was nothing but fanzines that were written. There wasn't social media, there weren't phones. I think that's ruined it for a lot of people, which is, you know, you just have to learn how to adapt to that. But, you know, it's like comedians not wanting people to film their show so that people won't see their act before they get there. I think that's kind of, you know, like the way people had to describe us to other people was more intriguing and, you know, made people want to see us because words were a hard way to describe us, you know.
I would counter you and say, no, I think you guys would be bigger now than ever. I think TikToks of any number one of your concerts, 15 seconds is also a needs to see of Give You With That Shotgun, and you would be the most talked about band. But in America,
talked about is one thing. You don't get paid when you're talked about. You get paid when people show up at your shows. So who's going to show up at the shows if they can watch it on TikTok and they've got to sit at home and drink some wine and watch, you know, whatever they got on Netflix? You know, I'm just saying.
Me. I know a lot of people. I think a lot of people see those videos and would be like, holy shit, this is worth leaving the house for. And I think going to the Butthole Surfers show would become like a social media outlet. It's that funny. I was actually speculating on different alternate realities for the Butthole Surfers. Like if that alternative music boom doesn't happen, which kind of fucks everything up on some level for the independent scene, and it kept going, would the Butthole Surfers have developed into kind of like a jam band type thing, you know, like the logical extension of Lollapalooza, not where your music gets terrible, I mean, but like where the fan base evolves to like following the band around and there's sort of like a separate economy based around each band. It's like you do see in the jam band scene.
Now, I think the mystery of Butthole Surfers, we never had our names on the records. We didn't have credits on the record. We, you know, like the only way you're going to get to see us or know us was to come out and see us. I think if it would have been like, you know, the Brady Bunch where each one of us had a square and you knew each one of us and all that, it wouldn't have been the same thing. I think the mystery of us was part of the appeal that we didn't individualize stuff. You know, like I said, when I was gone from the band, that didn't help my career. That we didn't have credits, you know, but it was something that people were drawn to. It's like, why does this band not have credits? And I always like to say, well, that would have taken like Photoshop and work. And, you know, we'd put Paul put the album artwork together and, you know, we didn't have like things to typeset our names and do all that stuff. And it was all, let's get this art out and do it. And we didn't, you know, we weren't ever like seeking individual stuff at that time. It was just a band. And I think that's kind of what people appreciated out of it. You know, it's later when people try and glorify members instead of the whole band together, then, you know, that's when changes things. You know, I think it's beautiful to have the mystery.
I would once again push back on that because I think all of you guys have done incredible solo records and have done incredible
speak for Jeff. I haven't.
I love your solo record. We talked about this last time. You downplay it, but I think your solo record's super awesome and super interesting. And I think obviously Trance Records is a really important label and there's stuff there. And like, I like Gibby stuff, like solo and the stuff you guys did together, Jeff, with Gibby. And like, I think there's like this whole, I don't know. I think everything you guys did was really interesting. And I think the band is fascinating and the individuals that did it. And like, that's bore out by the stuff you did post this band. Be it production work or be it other musical work and other stuff. And you keep doing interesting things. And that's the, So I think the band, I would have been fascinated if you guys had done like a Brady Bunch thing or done like a Melvins and each of you did a solo record back then under the Butthole Surfers umbrella. Like, I think all that stuff would have been fascinating given what you guys did afterwards.
Well, it's never too late. We're hitting it. We're all doing that stuff now. And we had the, We had the first time I've recorded with these guys in 30 years was just the other week. And I'm glad that that happened. And it was really nice to see a bunch of smiles and to have everybody working together for the first time. And we had a drum set set up for the King set up for Teresa, who couldn't be there, that he played. But we had a missing formation drum set, you know, in there to kind of, you know, come back and be able to enjoy each other and play with each other one more time. And I thought that was a beautiful thing. And if there's going to be any happy ending to our documentary, I would say that would be the happiest thing I could think of, was being able to enjoy a beautiful couple of days of recording with these guys and artistically throwing shit out at each other. You know, I needed it for my soul, for my heart, and I'm glad that we got to do it one last time.
I think it's great that you guys got together to play that, because I think, you know, the legacy of the band is certainly there in the recordings, and obviously for people that didn't get to experience it live in the videotapes that are out there, but to have it kind of be at peace with the members of it, there's a perfection of that, you know, and that's what you can only hope, that the members in the band realize how important what they did was for everybody outside of the band.
Speaking of which, we've got a live album coming out in the fall from a show that we played in New York City in 1992. And it's pretty hard hitting, and I'm excited about that. And then I was just contacted a few days ago by someone, excuse me, in London, who came across 3 24-track 2-inch tapes of us performing live in London in 1987.
Holy.
And so I'm waiting to get my hands on those tapes. You know, that would be Teresa era 2 drum kit with Pincus, and I'm really excited to get my hands on that and start mixing that album.
Was that from the Mad Hatter shows, or which shows were those ones? Do you know?
It said on the label, and I've already forgotten.
That gummy must be good, man.
It is.
Well, that's what I meant, though, about like becoming like a jam band. Like I love the idea of different shows and live recordings that exist of Butthole Surfers, and the idea that there is, it wasn't like a band going out playing the same set every night. Like every show is a performance, and every show does have that like different energy, and that's bore out by the live recordings that are already out there and the videos. Like I think that's what I would have loved to have seen, is sort of that culture that was kind of growing. It felt like that was growing late 80s into the very beginning of the 90s, and then obviously once the commercial potential of this music was revealed to the music industry, things changed, I think, greatly. Not for you guys, for everyone.
I remember the first time I saw a computer-generated set list was when we had a band wreck in Belgium. Well, we went separately. Teresa was with the band, unfortunately, when it wrecked on what I guess cobblestone is translated to baby's heads. Over there in Belgium and stuff, but I had to borrow a bunch of stuff, and I remember the Pixies had a computer generated set list, and I was blown away. I was like, wow, because we changed our list every night. We never did the same list. They were always like written out and, you know, Sharpie on a piece of paper, and you know, most of the times we got them in the right order when we were playing live, except for me sometimes. But it was every night we had such a catalog to pull from, and it was fun for us because we lived on the road, you know, so it was fun for us to change it up. You know, nowadays when I'm doing solo, I don't have a set list. I know about how long a 45 minute set list is. And sometimes I want to play a different song than I want to another time. When I play with other bands, you know, they want to do the same set every night and have it down. And it was just so much fun to, like, you know, to be part of a band that was like, yeah, we haven't played this in forever, let's do this one. And, you know, but we were always on top of our game, despite what it might have seemed like with people's ideas of our sobriety and whatever. We always pulled it together when we were up on stage. Even if I was too high to tune my bass, I'd have Paul come over, and he'd actually, like, you know, tune the knobs on my headstock at like CBGB's because I'm too high. You know, I mean, you know, we had each other's backs back then, or they didn't want to look bad, one or the other. I don't know. But, but you know, it was a different time, a different place. And again, we didn't think about everybody holding the cell phone up. And so if you fuck up, you're, you know, the whole world's going to know about it. You know, if someone was filming us, it was like a 16 mil projector, or 8 millimeter film or whatever, you know, like, there was no, you know, video cameras and stuff out there doing that stuff. I know this because they've been trying to find all that stuff for this documentary and had a really hard time.
But that's, that also, I think, you know, makes that show unique when the fuck ups do happen and the mistakes do happen. And the fact that
well,
show,
I mean, we got plenty of uniqueness, man.
Yeah, that's
most unique band in history.
Well, and that, and I say this as someone who has played with computer generated set lists at different times, like that's a result of the commodification of music where you have to replicate the product that you're putting out each and every night, which is what McDonald's does. It's what every largely successful company does. And that's what you kind of see post-alternative boom happen to this kind of music, where it wasn't about making unique, weird stuff. It was about making a consistent product that could be sold to people, to be as cynical as possible.
We were into creating bedlam. And so our shows were filled with setting the stage on fire and belching flames that went up to the ceiling and shotguns going off all the time. And it was freaking bedlam every night, and that can wear people down. And then I can remember on 9/11 watching those twin towers come down, and suddenly my whole perspective on everything changed. It's like, you know, maybe bedlam isn't so much fun anymore. I didn't want it anymore. I just,
how did the bedlam go over when you're on tour with like a Pearl Jam? Like when before that, like where you're now on tour with a band that's going out there and being like, we got to make a show, replicate this experience for everyone every night for each of these markets.
Yeah, I don't think Pearl Jam's crowd really dug us a whole lot.
I know, like, they did not dig us.
I can remember early on when we toured with them, and after the show one night, I went out to the parking lot to get on our bus. And our bus was surrounded by girls. I thought, all right, we finally made it. And then I fought my way through the girls and got onto the bus. And of course, it was Eddie Vedder on the back of the bus. And that's what they were there for. humbling experience.
I remember that we didn't really practice before that leg of the tour. And we got up there and played, and there was all these guys in like khaki shorts and the Izod shirts and stuff sitting in the front. And I remember this guy, or there's a few folks that were in the front row, and they're like flicking us off, and they're like, you suck. And we actually hadn't practiced that much. And I was like, you know, I want to be mad, but they're kind of right. We do kind of suck tonight, but we sucked in our own way. I think they would have hated us if we would have been the best version of ourselves. But to me, I was like, you know, I think we practiced like two times before that tour. And, you know, probably knowing that they were going to hate us no matter what we did. And those guys didn't talk to us at all. I remember me and Paul trying to talk to one of the fellas who rode up on his bicycle, the guy with the funny hat. And
yeah, the funny hat is all I remember. It's like, what the fuck, dude? What the fuck are you wearing that shit fucking hat for? God fucking damn.
Both me and Paul were standing there. He got off his bike right next to us, and we were like, hey, thanks for having us on this tour. And he just kind of looked at us and walked off. And I remember Eddie came up to us on the day that we were leaving the tour, and he got up on our bus and goes, wow, I really wish that we could have spent some more time together. And I'm just in my head going,
no, you don't.
You knew where our dressing room was. It was right down the hall from you. You never came by fucking once, dude. Yeah, I think it was Chris Kirkwood wanted to kick his ass for some reason, but that's just Chris, you know. But at least the Meat Puppets came by during that tour to say hi to us, you know, made us feel normal again. But yeah, that was not the most welcoming tour for us. And that was during the time when we played with Stone Temple Pilots and Nirvana. It was like a whole run of playing with all these bands that that say they liked us but were way more successful than us.
Well, that's the way it is, right? You have to take the realist version of the thing, and then you got to water it down to make it mass marketable. Otherwise, you know, everything would be cooler. It's always like the watered down version of the thing that becomes the version that takes off with people.
Yeah, the most easy to digest version. Yeah.
Like, what did you guys think of when you started seeing bands in kind of the 90s begin to sort of adopt the wild bedlam live show? Obviously not doing what you're doing, but like, you know, I think of Partner for Pyros, or before that was Jane's Addiction, or you think about a lot of these bands. Stone Temple Pilots even kind of like going for that a little bit. Red Hot Chili Peppers maybe a little bit less so, but kind of still going for that kind of vibe that you guys were doing, but like once again a watered down version of.
I never noticed it.
I never noticed it either. I didn't think they were doing that.
Yeah, I mean, other than Scott Whelan using a bullhorn and Gibby coming up on stage with his bullhorn and pulling his pants down and screaming at Scott while he was on stage. But that was probably about as close to that as I saw.
I never noticed that they were Swagger Jack and Red Cross until I watched that Red Cross documentary, and they kind of point out various Stone Temple Pilots songs that were kind of aping Red Cross stuff. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I would have liked Stone Temple Pilots a lot more if they had played up these influences maybe a little heavier.
I just thought Robert DeLeo wanted to be Led Zeppelin. I don't know. I just, you know, like I didn't catch that, the Red Cross part of it. But
I would have liked to have seen a band that had four Dean DeLeos in it. Now, that guy was fucking cool as shit, and he's a great fucking guitar player and a lot of fun, and I would have liked to see four of those guys together on stage.
I think he had a broken arm when we were on tour with him, didn't he? He had a cast on his arm.
Are you sure that wasn't me? I know I had a cast.
No, that was after I left the band and you punched the wall backstage.
Oh, it was a door. Yeah, that's turned out to be a solid door.
Yeah, bad idea.
Oh, shit. Well, this has been an amazing time, and I know you got to get on the road, Pinky, so I don't want to keep you all day. And if you guys want to come back again separately or together, the door is always open for you.
I'm up for either and any or whatever, but yeah, I love Paul. I love talking to you, Damien. Thanks so much for having me on here, man.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Save big money on your next project now at Menard. Brighten up your garage or workspaces with LED utility and panel light bulbs from GT Light. GT Light light bulbs are energy efficient, and with their easy adjustable light panels, you can direct light where you need it most. Save big on all GT industrial utility and panel light bulbs. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer for more hot deals happening now. Save big.